Our show's name pays tribute to the Boer Trekkers of South Africa, who in 1838 soundly defeated 30,000 Zulus on the bank of the Nkomo River, thereafter called Blood River, from the water turning red with the blood of the slain. Miraculously, no Boer Trekker died and only three were wounded. Now, your friend, Eddie Miller, will be your ambassador for tonight's show.
Dear Blood River family, thank you so much for holding on. I'm sorry I stumbled over my own voice then. We're getting ready to bring the bitter end around right now. I think Lizzie's working to get him on, but until we get him on, I'd just like to recap what we've done, especially a few people that are just coming on. We have people that may work and they play, because after all, it is Saturday, and different people come in at different times. It's a lot of people don't listen to a three-hour program, and I can understand that totally. I'm that way myself, but we do have archives. I'm very proud of the wonderful job our webmaster does. Also, I just remembered, I forgot to name the donors. I'm almost positive I forgot to name the people who contributed. I usually do that in the first hour after the prayer. But we had a few technical difficulties and kind of threw me. It doesn't take much to throw me off. But anyway, we had Miss Buddy. Miss Buddy, never-ending Miss Buddy. And Miss Buddy and Jay-Z from Blood River Radio Zone AZ, they contributed this month. And I'm really so proud of those people. They kept us going. Anyway, people, we've got the, without further ado, we've got the bitter end himself, Gene Andrews, on. And he's going to continue up with the Confederate history. I talked to him earlier today when I was really, I was on the fritz. I didn't know if I was going to make it, but I made a miraculous recovery. Anyway, bitter ender, how you doing there, brother?
Doing very well. Glad to hear you back. You didn't sound too good earlier today. I was hoping you were going to make a speedy recovery to give the life to the program. So,
well, you know, anytime you're on these medicines like we are, and like you said, we're getting older, these medicines have some of, I have this incompatibility chart. As a matter of fact, Biscuit sent it to me. And some of the medicines I'm on, and I would bet you a lot of people out there are on medicines, and they're kind of incompatible. It's kind of like a damned if you do, damned if you don't. You can either have cardiac fib, dysrhythmias and stuff like that, or you can take this crappy medicine. It's kind of a lesser of the two poisons. But anyway, with that being said, thank God I'm back here. Thank God you're here, Bitter Ender. And I'm really looking forward to another lesson on Confederate history. And I like to say this to the people. I think last week, the Bitter Ender had done many, many incredible programs. I don't know if it's just me, but I think last week might have been, if he's ever done a better than that one, I can't remember when. It's one of the best presentations I had ever heard. It was better than going to the movies. It was better than going to a play. And the best thing about it of all is true history. It gets rid of these evil, vicious, crappy lies that our enemies always try to put us, stick us with our conscience. We need to feel guilty for being evil Confederate history. We talked about that. Monica talked about that in the second hour. Paul Fromm talked about that. Our evil people, these people that wear the tiny little hats, these men wear the tiny little hats, are forever trying to make us feel ashamed, make us feel guilty. They can make us feel guilty. They can make us, we're their slaves. But the bitter ender, he is really forging ahead and knocking the hell out of these stupid lives, and he's giving you true, true history through and through. With that, I'm going to shut up and go back to the Bitter Ender. So glad to have you here, Bitter Ender.
No, thank you for the introduction. I hope I can live up to it.
You have.
No, we had a good time last week. We were talking about the Atlanta campaign that Sherman took under his command to try to move the Federal Army from Chattanooga down to Atlanta and knock out one of the major manufacturing and railroad centers in the South. And the thing we were talking about, if you're traveling down I-75 from Chattanooga to Atlanta and then on down to Florida, you can go by all of these exits and you'll see these signs for all the battles that we talked about, starting out at Dalton, Georgia, and the pass through the mountains right there, and then Resaca and Adairsville and Allatoona, and then you get down to Kennesaw, and then, of course, crossing the Chattahoochee River coming into Atlanta there. So all of that area is still very well marked, and there's quite a few small battlefields that you can go see there before you actually get into the city of Atlanta. So anyway, that being said, we did that because most of those battles right around the city of Atlanta took place at the, in the end of July. So we try to come up with some kind of Confederate history that happened in the month that we're talking about right now. And we've got another one of those today. We're going to talk about the battle at Mobile Bay, a naval battle that was fought on August the 5th in 1864. So we're going to back up a little bit and talk about some of the obstacles that the South faced in its war for Southern independence and had a huge mountain to climb over here. The South was hit with, they fought a modern war. And in modern wars, a manufacturing company can always defeat an agricultural country. And this is what happened to our attempt at independence. So the South had a lack of manufacturing facilities. They were strong on land, but powerless at sea. And it was nonetheless the sea which the South caused the South's ultimate lack of survival. And it was the sea that the South really depended on to have supplies brought in by blockade runners from Europe, especially England. And England was supplying both sides. They were selling to the North and selling to the South. They were loving it. They were hoping the bloody Yanks over there across the pond would kill each other off for about the next 100 years. So they were supplying both sides in that. Now, the blockade runners were taking cotton to England. And then they were bringing back medical supplies and war materials to the South. The U.S. Navy had the job of blockading the southern ports and 3,550 miles of coastline and about 185 harbor and river openings to the Gulf and to the southern Atlantic. So if you look at the map and how water played such an important part in this war, if you look at the eastern theater of the war that was fought primarily in Virginia, the rivers there were actually barriers between Washington and Richmond because most of them flowed from west to east and emptied into the Chesapeake Bay. But if you look out here in the western theater of the war, the rivers in this part of the country that the South was trying to defend were like daggers that were pointed right into the heart of the central South in the Southland. You had the Mississippi River flowing from north down to south that actually split the part of the Confederacy off, the Trans-Mississippi Department. So Arkansas, Texas, and the parts of Louisiana and the Indian nations were separated from the rest of the Confederacy if that the river defenses on the Mississippi failed, which they finally did. Then you had the Tennessee River that came out of eastern Tennessee, down across northern Alabama, and then turned back north and went up to the Ohio. And if the Federal Navy could control that, they could split off Tennessee and Kentucky from the South. And then right here in our city of Nashville, you had the Cumberland River, which was really a barrier. It could have been used as a barrier between the states of Kentucky and Tennessee. But once Nashville fell, then that gave the Federal Navy easy access to Nashville and its four railroads that they could use to supply their armies going into the South. So, and then going back one more, if you look at the Ohio River, it flowed from east to west, but it wasn't really a barrier. The South never got an army posted up along the Ohio to keep Indiana and Illinois and Ohio from crossing over. So the Ohio River was really more of an asset to the Federal Navy and Federal armies than it was a barrier that the South could use. The Confederate Navy really had to be built from scratch, and it's amazing what Stephen Mallory, the Secretary of the Navy, could actually do to get a Navy put together that in some areas was very formidable and actually defeated the much larger U.S. Navy in places like Charleston, and Charleston held out for a long time. In fact, Charleston, the siege that the Federal Army and Navy laid against Charleston, South Carolina, was the longest siege of any city in the Western Hemisphere. Now, you could go back to Troy and some of the other cities in the Eastern Hemisphere, but the siege at Charleston lasted for over 3 years. The city held out under intense bombardment from siege guns on land and naval guns on board the Federal Navy. But anyway, they had shipbuilding yards across the South and a lot of the port cities, Norfolk, Virginia, Savannah, Georgia, Charleston, New Orleans, and Mobile, Alabama. Now, the South had plenty of wood for building hulls and the interior structure of the ship. but very few iron-producing facilities in the South. In fact, the state of Pennsylvania could produce more iron than the entire South could in a year's time. New Orleans was by far the biggest shipbuilding yards in the South, but New Orleans fell to the enemy, to Farragut's fleet, in April of 1862, so it was knocked out of the war pretty early. Even with that being said, the South, during the four-year course of the war, built 22 of these ironclad ships. And we'll get back and talk about that right after our break and give you a little more information on that.
Thank you, Jim.
Are you ready to stand up for your community and support your local sheriff? Join the Constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association and become a vital member of the Sheriff's Citizens Posse. At CSPOA.org, we empower citizens like you through weekly webinars, arming you with the knowledge to back your constitutional county sheriff. Together, we can uphold our Constitution and ensure liberty and justice for all. Your community needs you now more than ever.
Hey, this is Matt from Blood River Radio. Blood River Radio is your voice to save our land, our people, and our future. We propose Christian solutions to an anti-Christian assault on our bloodlines. We love what we do, but we cannot do it without your help. The annual operating cost of Blood River Radio is more than even a team of people should bear alone. With your donation, we can take the fight to our enemies and hold our own people accountable for their treachery against us. Please go to our website, www.bloodriverradio.com, and find a way to help us that is suitable for you. We are thankful for any cash, check, or money orders we get. We also appreciate your correspondence or letters of encouragement. Once again, please help, and thank you for joining the fight.
This is a battle between truth and deceit, a battle between forces that would enslave this country in darkness and between a media that wants to present you with the truth.
We are being censored. America's news outlets no longer provide the truth. 90% of news outlets in the United States are controlled by six corporations. The mission of the Epoch Times is to chase the truth, to ground all statements in fact.
TheEpochTimes.com.
What we've got here is failure to communicate. Some men you just can't reach.
Dear Blood River Radio family, without further ado, we go back to the Bitter Ender. If there's time, I got a couple of questions to ask about logistics and stuff to the Bitter Ender, him to ask him. Anyway, back to you, Gene. Go ahead, brother.
No, go ahead and fire away with your questions. As long as it doesn't have anything to do with math, I can't help you on that.
I got you. Well, you were talking about, one thing I'll make a comment. We were talking about during the break that General Forrest had the right idea about attacking. He knew we could not possibly fight a much larger Union army, that they could continually replace their losses with the people from Hessians, from Germany, and from the Irish. We just couldn't do that. So he said he was going to attack them for their supply lines. And I was thinking, making a comment, the longer we could get those Yankees to stretch their supply lines, the better opportunity he would have to hit them in a lot of larger area.
But exactly. Also,
I was also going to say, did we have, you may not know this, did we be in the South, did we have any steel, any ironworking mills rented? I know over in what I call the Quad City in Alabama, Sheffield, yeah. Florence, and also Birmingham, I believe we had some steel. Do we have any steel mills there, any steel manufacturing?
Well, Birmingham didn't come along till after the war. There was a little settlement there called Elton, I think it was, or something like that. It was future Birmingham. But they did have Selma, Alabama, and they had iron works there and foundries there. And a lot of the Confederate artillery was made there. And we're going to talk about how they made the iron plating and actually built one of the biggest Confederate ironclads that the Confederate Navy ever had was built in Selma and then taken down the Alabama River to Mobile Bay. We'll get into that in just a minute. But we're talking about they did, with all that behind them, the Confederates actually built 22 ironclad ships. And, of course, probably the most famous was the Virginia, or some people call it the Merrimack. But it was built over the hull of an old U.S. frigate, the USS Merrimack, in Gosport Navy Yards in Norfolk after the Federal Navy abandoned it and left that. And the Confederates came over and took over the Navy Yard there in Norfolk. The problem they ran into with that is they built the metal casement up over the gun deck, and it was the first of its kind to be built in North America. But it was built over the hull of an ocean-going ship. So an ocean-going ship has a very deep keel to keep it from being knocked over on the high seas out in the ocean. Now, all the other Confederate ironclads that were built had a very shallow keel or hull on it, so it could be used in harbors and rivers. And the problem they had with the Virginia, of course, it went out in March of 1862 and destroyed part of the Federal blockade squadron that was there in Chesapeake Bay, or Hampton Roads, it was called, that part of Chesapeake Bay. But when Norfolk fell to the Federal Army that had landed south of there, and they were threatening to retake the naval yards at Norfolk, they couldn't bring the Virginia up the James River. It had too deep a draft, and it wasn't a flat-bottomed ship built for going up rivers and in harbors. Now, the flat-bottomed ships that the Confederates had, they could defend harbors and rivers, but they couldn't take them out in the middle of the Atlantic and go out there because, you know, the first storm they ran into, they'd be flipped over and sunk. So the Virginia couldn't go up the James River and help defend Richmond. So the Confederates had to pack it full of gunpowder and set it on fire and just blow it up to keep the Federals from getting it. And in fact, that's what happened to most of these other ironclads. There was only one of these 22 ironclad ships that the Confederates built that was ever defeated in a naval battle. The rest of them were very successful. But when the Federal Army was closing in on Charleston or Savannah or Wilmington or any of these cities from the land side, they didn't want their naval ships to fall into the hands of the enemy and then be turned around and used to attack other southern port cities. So the only thing left for them to do was just burn the ship up or like I said, pack it full of gunpowder and set it on fire and blow it up so the Federal Navy couldn't use it. Well, anyway, that being said, they built these ironclads to defend all these southern port cities. And the one we're going to talk about today was the CSS Tennessee. And this is the largest ironclad ship that the Confederate Navy built. It was 1,200 tons, 209 feet long, and it was built, the hull and the engines and so forth were put in the interior part. It was built in Selma, Alabama. And it was probably the most powerful ironclad that was built by the Confederacy. And they ran, it took a long time because they had a shortage of labor and materials. There were long delays on this. The construction started in October of 62, and they finally built the hull and got it towed down the Alabama River to Mobile Bay for completion down there in February of 1863. But it had a lot of deficiencies. Number one, the engines were too small. They had two engines in there. They were too small for such a large ship. And the other thing that really hurt it, and we'll talk about it when we get into the actual battle, they ran chains across the rear deck for steering and pulling on the rudder to steer the ship. And that proved disastrous in the battle. Now, the ship, the Tennessee, basically the hull and some of the guns that were already in it, got down the Alabama River, but they couldn't get out into Mobile Bay because of a place called the Dog River Bar, a sandbar there. And it took on, even though it had a flat bottom, it still sank too low in the water to get over the bar. So what they used, now the Confederates were pretty ingenious at coming up with a lot of things. They were way behind on a lot of stuff, but they could figure a lot of things out. They came up with these wooden pontoons they put around the hull of the ship. They were called camels. Wow. And they would fill them with water, and it would sink down. But then when they pumped the water out, these pontoons attached to the ship would raise it up, and it got it up just barely enough to get over the sandbar and get down to Mobile Bay.
Wow.
So it finally got across on May the 17th, and the captain of the that was assigned to the Alabama was Captain Franklin Buchanan. And you may remember that name. We talked about him back in March he was captain of the CSS Virginia that went after the federal fleet there in Hampton Roads. And they sank two of the frigates, the Cumberland and the Congress, and then they went after the Minnesota, and it took off and ran aground. Once again, an ocean-going ship with a deep hull and a keel under it. It ran aground, and the Virginia was going to come back the next day and take it out, and then that's when they ran into the Monitor on the next day there, and they had the first battle of the ironclad ships. They also remember that when they sank the Congress, the federal sailors were bailing off of that. The ship was burning and going down, and Captain Buchanan, or Admiral Buchanan, came in there with the Virginia to try to pick these men up out of the water. There's sort of an unwritten rule among sailors. You don't let a fellow sailor die, even if he's the enemy. You don't let him drown if you can get him out of there. So they were trying to pick these northern sailors up out of the water to keep them from drowning. And then the federal army soldiers over at Fortress Monroe were shooting the Confederates because they were picking the U.S. sailors out of the water. And they shot Captain Buchanan, or Admiral Buchanan, in the leg. He was wounded, and he didn't get to participate in the next day's battle against the Monitor. It was Catesby Jones who then took command of the Virginia and fought against the Monitor. Anyway, just a little background information. So
you know what,
he was put in charge of the ironclad, the Tennessee, down in Mobile Bay, and it got across the bar on May 17th. They got the guns placed where they wanted them, and Franklin Buchanan had planned to crash through the blockade at Pensacola and attack Fort Pickens, the federal fort there. The Federals held on to two forts in the south, Fort Sumter in Charleston Harbor and Fort Pickens in Pensacola Harbor. They didn't abandon them, and they were going to use those forts to blockade those two cities. Of course, Fort Sumter finally fell to the Confederates, but Fort Pickens at Pensacola Harbor remained a Yankee fort throughout the course of the war. So his plan was to come out of Mobile Bay, crash through the blockade squadron, head over to Pensacola and take out Fort Pickens, but the Tennessee ran aground on some low ground there in the Mobile Bay, and it took longer to get it off than planned, so they kind of dropped that idea of going to Pensacola. Now, in August, Admiral David Farragut, in January of 1864, Admiral David Farragut began planning the capture of Mobile Bay. And by August, his fleet of 14 wooden ships and four of these iron monitors, you know, just had a flat deck with a round turret on it. And they said it looked like a cheese box on a raft, but they were completely made out of iron, were ready for battle with Fort Morgan and Admiral Franklin Buchanan's small fleet of three gunboats, they were wooden gunboats, and the ironclad Tennessee. Now, Farragut's fleet entered the main channel at dawn on August the 5th, with the monitors out in the lead and the wooden ships coming behind, and they were lashed in pairs in case one of them got really torn up by artillery fire from Fort Morgan and Fort Gaines on either side of Mobile Bay. If one of them got damaged so bad it was about to sink, the other ship that was lashed to could hold it up until they got it out of range of the guns. The ships, and then what happened? When the federal fleets were coming in with their ironclad monitors in the lead, the monitor Tecumseh struck a mine and went down. And it went down so fast that most of the crew went down with it. These things were really hard to get out of because you had that round turret on top and a couple of hatches. And once it started rolling over and going down, it took most of the crew down with it. And supposedly, there was a lot of confusion. Some of the ships behind stopped, and Farragut ordered his flagship, the Hartford, to go on through. What happened was the Confederates had laid mines in part of the harbor, out in the middle of the harbor, to force these Yankee ships right under the guns of Fort Morgan. And we'll go back and continue our battle at Mobile Bay in just a minute.
Only good Yankees and dead Yankees. Be right back, folks.
How would you like to help this program reach more people and earn silver at the same time? Call or text 801-669-2211 for complete details.
news this hour from Town Hall. I'm Mary Rose. A first-of-its-kind gathering Friday at Camp David. The White House says it was the first live televised cabinet meeting ever held at the presidential retreat in Maryland, offering the public a rare look inside the historic compound. A Republican senator from Missouri is pushing legislation aimed at preventing judge shopping in federal courts. Correspondent Ken Lorman has the details.
Senator Eric Schmidt has introduced the Boasberg Act, named after U.S. District Judge Jeb Boasberg, who is accused of being a rogue judge and has repeatedly handled high-profile cases against President Trump's agenda. Schmidt says the measure would require random assignment of federal cases, increase transparency, and impose penalties for attempts to manipulate the process.
President Trump says the U.S. is keeping up military pressure on Iran, warning that American strikes will continue until Tehran can no longer threaten U.S. interests. The White House says Iran has broken past agreements and continues to target shipping and American personnel. K.T. McFarland, former deputy national security advisor to President Trump, tells the Salem Radio Network she would like to find out who allowed Dr. Fauci to resume the potentially very dangerous gain-of-function research in China after the Obama administration terminated the practice.
You know government, there's always a paper trail. No government official, just by their very nature, government officials don't want to be out on a limb and committing themselves to anything without authorization from somebody. So you know there's a paper trail for it. I'd like to see the paper trail. Who gave permission to turn it back on and to have gain-of-function research that was happening because it was illegal? You couldn't do it in the United States.
More on these stories at townhall.com.
Larry Elder here. When it comes to supplements, two things matter most. Does it work? And can you trust it? Rather than just tell you about Relief Factor, we'll let our customers do it. We hear from people every single day whose lives have changed, and we'd like you to hear a few of their stories. Chris has spent years doing physical work, leaving his feet sore at the end of the day. After starting Relief Factor, he felt so good he did something he'd never done before. He ran a half marathon. Now he tells all his friends about Relief Factor. I've got back issues. I've been taking Relief Factor every single morning for years. Without it, the back problems come back. They make it easy to find if you'll be the next person telling us Relief Factor gave you your life back. 3 weeks for just $17.76. Simply go to ReliefFactor.com. That's ReliefFactor.com or call 800-4-RELIEF, 800-4-RELIEF. You'll connect with our friendly local team and they'll do everything they can to help. We hope you'll be soon sharing your story with us too. ReliefFactor.com, 800-4-RELIEF.
Okay, listen up, people. I'm beating the bushes for a few good men. I don't want you boys the alt-right. I want the hardcore of the hard-right. And I need you front and center, boots on the ground, at a minute's notice, in the streets, and I need your money. You know the problem that the whites of the world face. It's the all-too-real threat of global extermination. And you know what's going on in South Africa and Western Europe. And unless you're semi-comatose, you've already seen the first stages of white genocide unfolding in our country. Our culture is under constant full-scale attack by our enemy. The enemy never sleeps. They spend day and night wrecking the monuments and the graves of our beloved kin. They attack us physically everywhere we go. They've already taken the linen and our stone. Now they're coming after our flesh. And if you're not too squeamish, if you want to be part of the number one white advocacy group and the number one white civil defense group in the United States, then contact Eddie Bombardier Miller at BloodRiverRadio.com. And please, please donate. And God knows you need us as much as we need you. Thank you.
Looking for an IT partner that truly understands your needs? Managed IT Services is the answer. We meet with you regularly to discuss your goals and form a tailored technology plan. Our customers have called us a trusted advisor who delivers. When it comes to IT, we do it all. Firewalls, cloud storage, server migration, and more. Say goodbye to long-term contracts and hello to a team that earns your business month after month. Call 801-706-6980 now and let Managed IT Services transform your IT experience.
Have you ever had great honey? No, I mean really good, all-natural, raw honey. Well, now you can, thanks to localhoneyman.com. We can ship out our locally made honey all across the U.S. So don't worry, you won't miss out. Plus, Local Honeyman has so many different flavors, like Utah Wildflower, High Desert Delight, Happy Valley, and Blackberry, just to name a few. So purchase your delicious raw honey today at localhoneyman.com.
I'll tell you one thing that every good soldier knows. The only thing that counts in the end is power. Naked, merciless force!
Dear Blood River Radio family, I just wish you could hear. We need to start recording what goes on there in the breaks. Man, I just had the most wonderful history lesson. We're going to get Gene to come on one of these days soon. We need to start a series, Gene, sometime on the first war of independence. You just gave me a great lesson. So anyway, I got to shut up and go right back to you, Gene, and continue on, brother.
Well, we've got time. We've got two more segments. Just what we were talking about during the break was that President Davis held cotton and wouldn't send it to England at the first of the war. He was hoping this was going to put enough pressure on England to get them to join the war on the side of the South. If the mills, the textile mills in England were all shut down, and a lot of them were, and a lot of the people were thrown out of work, and a lot of the British workers there were starving, and quite a few of them died of starvation. Their families were in bad shape, but not bad enough to make the British government come to the aid of the South and help the South out. What they were hoping, this was going to be just like the French helping the American patriots or colonists in their war against England in our first war for independence. And, you know, if had it not been for France, we would still be part of the British Empire. And our government would be in London, not in Washington, which I don't know, may be a lot better than what it is today. But anyway, that's another time for another story. So it was the French Navy that actually drove the British Navy away from Yorktown, Virginia, and blockaded the city, the British fort there, fortifications at Yorktown. And then the French Army and the American Army were able to pin Cornwallis up against the Chesapeake Bay there and surround them at Yorktown and finally force the surrender of Cornwallis and a major British army. And that was pretty much what turned the tide in the war for American independence, because the British, they controlled all the major cities on the East Coast. They controlled New York. They controlled Boston. They controlled Philadelphia, Charleston, and had burned Washington, D.C., which that sounded like there was something terrible. But no, that was in retaliation for the Americans going across the border and burning York, Canada, which is today Toronto. And the Canadians wouldn't join the Americans in their war for independence. So they said, well, the heck with you. We'll just burn your city. That's a good way to get people on your side. So they burned York.
Yes.
And the British, of course, Canada at that time wasn't an independent country as part of the British Empire. So the British, in retaliation for the Americans burning York, turned around and burned Washington, D.C. And, you know, that's why we have a White House that wasn't white until the British burned it, and then to cover up all the scorched walls and everything that was there when they rebuilt the interior, they painted the exterior white. And so that's why it was called the President's Residence at that time. And then after they had to repaint it, after the British burned it, it got the name the White House. So anyway, that and, you know, a dollar will get you a cup of coffee somewhere, maybe. Well, it won't get you a cup of coffee at Starbucks, but anyway. So back to this naval battle on August the 5th in 1864 in Mobile Bay. So Farragut on dawn on August the 5th comes steaming into Mobile Bay. And they are what they're going to try to do is take out the Confederate Navy there and silence the two forts, Fort Morgan on the east side and Fort Gaines on the west side of Mobile Bay. And they're still there, and you can tour those two forts. Fort Morgan is a U.S. military park, national park, and Fort Gaines is run by the state of Alabama. But I've been to both of those, so you can sort of see what went on there. And then they came under fire from the naval guns at Fort Morgan, and then the column of ships were led by the ironclads, the monitors, and one of the monitors out in the lead, the Tecumseh, hit a mine, and it went down immediately, took the whole crew down with it. And the other ships were stopping and trying to figure out if they ought to turn around or go back, and the guns at Fort Morgan were raking the decks with artillery fire. Until Farragut ordered the ships to get back in column and forced his flagship, the Hartford, to go through the minefield. Now, the Confederates had laid mines out in the middle of the harbor, which meant the only channels that were open were right up by Fort Morgan, or on the west side of the channel, right by Fort Gaines. So you had to go through, just literally pass underneath the guns of these two forts, and that was the whole point. You couldn't come down the middle of Mobile Bay, and they'd placed mines in there, and they were pretty effective. The Confederate torpedo, they called them torpedoes back then, but the Confederate torpedo department, actually, in the history of the course of the war, the torpedo department sank more enemy warships than all of the Confederate surface ships and all of the coastal forts combined. They were the Confederate torpedo department under one of the Raines brothers was pretty deadly, and they were pretty good at it. And some of them were even electrically detonated mines, where they would have like a battery on shore, and they would have like a stick floating out in the harbor or the river, like a piece of driftwood, and they, when they'd see a ship, a Yankee ship, hit that stick and tip it over, they would touch these two wires together, and the mine would explode right there. But what happened was they had these mines out in the harbor forcing the Yankees to come in close to Fort Morgan and Fort Gaines, but they'd been in the water for so long that a lot of the fuses didn't work. And so the Yankee sailors said they could hear the hull of their ship bumping up against these mines. And I mean, they were holding their breath because they thought any minute the hull was going to be blown out from underneath them, and they were going to be swimming around in Mobile Bay. But the Tecumseh was the only one that actually went down. These other ships were bumping up against these mines that were defective. The fuses were defective and they weren't exploding. So if they had just had some fresh mines put in there, it may have been an entirely different story. But anyway, they got into Mobile Bay, and there were three Confederate wooden gunboats that tried to take on Farragut's fleet. Of course, they shot them to pieces, and they were out of there in no time. The only ship left was the Confederate ironclad, the Tennessee. So now the Tennessee had to take on 14 of Farragut's regular sailing ships, you know, like hull and the mast and everything, and four of these ironclads. And so it went after them and went out into the bay there to try to take them on, do what damage they could to them. And the guns at Fort Morgan and Fort Gaines were still firing away at targets on the federal ships, trying to hit them and help out the Tennessee. So the Tennessee was pretty much surrounded by all the federal fleet. They had 17 of these ships just circling around them, around the Tennessee, just pounding it with artillery. Eventually, they shot the smokestack away, which meant that they couldn't raise enough heat in the boilers to make steam. So it was pretty much the engines they had there were way too small. We talked about that, to move this big a ship, and a ship that was that heavy. So they were at a disadvantage right from the start, but then when they shot the smokestack away, then they even lost even more power, so it had very little power to actually try to ram these federal ships, and it did. It tried to ram Farragut's flagship, the Hartford, but it wasn't going fast enough to ram that the ram that was built underwater on the bow of the Tennessee. Wasn't going fast enough to ram it through the hull and knock a hole in the Hartford or any of these other wooden ships and sink them. And then the other thing that happened that was a disaster for the Tennessee, the design flaw that they made of running these chains across the deck on the stern third of the ship to go to the rudder to steer it. Well, once these chains got shot away, then they had no way to turn the ship. And it was just floating in the tide that was running out of the bay there. And it was just a sitting target for these all these federal ships to just keep circling around and around it and just keep pounding it with heavy guns and artillery fire until it finally got so many shots it started to knock the iron plating off the side of the ship, and artillery shells were coming right through the side of the Tennessee and exploding, and the crew was being killed off by that. And that's when Admiral Buchanan decided to surrender the ship before everybody in the crew got killed. It was a three-hour battle out there in Mobile Bay. Like I said, the two things that really got it, they shot away the smokestack, and they were losing steam, and then the the anchor, the steering chains were shot off of the rear deck or the stern deck of the ship. So this was pretty much the end of the Confederate control of Mobile Bay. They finally got troops on land and marched them over to attack Fort Morgan and Fort Gaines from the land side. And they did capture the Tennessee, and I've seen pictures of it flying. They used it as one of their ships in the Yankee blockade and had the Yankee flag flying off the back of the Tennessee. And later on after the war, it was just pretty much sold for scrap to get all that metal taken off there. So we'll come back after the break, and we'll wrap up a few things, a few more things on the Confederate Navy, and I hope our listeners learned a little something about the battle at Mobile Bay on August the 5th.
Well, I sure learned it. We'll learn some more when we come back. Be right back, folks.
As you are aware, America is divided over every fault line possible. This is intentionally fostered by those who do not love God, family, or country. We believe a peaceful future as a free people absolutely depends on civility. Clarion Call for Civility is looking for funding and volunteers at every level to make our hopes and efforts a reality. Please donate, sign our pledge, and help us in our sacred cause. Please visit callforcivility.com for more details. callforcivility.com.
Blood River Radio is the only news media in the United States whose sole purpose of being is to fight against the ever-rising tide of global white genocide, both soft and hard genocide, whether it is in the form of ethnic cleansing via the current massive invasion of non-white, non-Christian hordes that are overwhelming the once all-white nations of Western Europe, the United Kingdom, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and the United States, or via the hard genocide in South Africa, where the rape, murder, and torture of whites is an ongoing daily occurrence. Though we are a Christian brotherhood, we will cooperate with other groups in our operations if it will shorten our people's casualty list. We further pledge to you to leave the radio studio at every opportunity and take it to our churches, to our universities, and most importantly, we promise to occupy the streets. However, none of our mission can succeed without funding. Please help us all that you can and donate to our cause by going to www.bloodriverradio.com.
Get ready to be part of something incredible. We're breaking barriers and delivering the powerful stories that mainstream media won't touch. Your support is what fuels our mission to revolutionize journalism and bring you the truth. Join our passionate community of changemakers by donating at libertynewsradio.com today. Together, we're creating the future of news.
Tell you something, boy, if I did give you power, you got nothing. Nobody gives you power. Real power is something you take.
Hey, Blood River Radio family. I'm going to ask the bitter editor, I'm really getting into this the last couple of weeks. I'm asking one question. Hope it didn't get you off the track here, Gene, but I'm about the different, so-called technology, I guess, of the projectiles that the Confederates and the Unions both fired. And asked Gene, were they all in the shape of round balls or like longer in the ballistic parlance, you'd say sectional density, the amount of weight per square inch in the frontal area. In other words, a long bullet will have
exactly.
More penetration.
Yeah, they had those. It was called shrapnel. And they look like a giant bullet that would be fired out of a cannon or some of these big heavy coastal guns in places like Fort Sumter or Fort Morgan and Fort Gaines in Mobile Bay. And of course, the round ones, the solid shot, the cannonballs, they were just used for knocking down brick walls of forts or earthworks or things like that. But the shrapnel, they were exploding shells, and they would have a fuse that was screwed into the nose of the shell, the pointed nose of the shell. And they would have a chart on the boxes of ammunition for the length to cut the fuse in this, the fuse that was being screwed into this artillery shell. And you cut it at a certain length to explode at 200 yards, 400 yards, 500 yards. Some of them had a range of out to 800 yards, half a mile. And so they were pretty accurate, and you could get an air burst with it. But a lot of times when you were firing against these ships, when it hits something that was solid, like an iron casement on a ship there, the impact would cause it to explode right there on the side of the ship and knock off some of those armor plates. So that's what they were using against the Tennessee, that all of Farragut's ships had switched to those exploding shells to just try to pound it into pieces. And they pretty much did. When they could get as close as they wanted to, they could almost go hull to hull with it and just roll the cannons out and fire from about 8 or 9 yards away and just really blast holes in the side of the Tennessee. And it was trying to do the same thing against the Federal ships, but it couldn't turn and get a broadside against them because, like I said, the rudder chains had been shot away. So they had to wait for the Federal ships to come around them before they could get a broadside firing at the Federal Navy. A lot of this information came from a really good book that we have called Warships and Naval Battles of the Civil War. And it goes into some description about Mobile Bay. And they even have a sort of a painting of what the battle at Mobile Bay looked like, and Fort Donelson and the Virginia and the Monitor. And yeah, the phone's working now. They're the phone that we couldn't get a connection on when we started. Then on all these pages, they have artists' paintings or renderings, really, almost they look like color photographs of all of these Confederate ironclads and the Northern monitors, and then a lot of the surface ships. This may be a good program for us to have sometime. I've enjoyed going back through and reading this again. We can talk about the Confederate Navy again on the cruisers that they had. These were ships that they bought from the English and fitted them out as warships. And that was an attempt by the Confederate Navy to destroy the U.S. Maritime economy. And they were ships like the Alabama. It actually sank or captured and sank 69 U.S. merchant ships during the course of the war. And then there were other ships like the Florida, the Shenandoah, Nashville, and they damaged the U.S. merchant marine so much that it pretty much went out of business. And the idea was that they would have to take ships off the blockade to try to chase these ships down in the North and South Atlantic or the Indian Ocean or the Pacific or wherever they were, and pull some ships off the blockade. Or at least, if they really got bad, put enough economic pressure on the North that they would make some kind of deal to give us our independence. And Lincoln wouldn't listen to the merchants in the North, in Boston and New York and Providence and all these port cities that were going bankrupt because all their ships were being sunk. His whole determination was to crush the South and force us at gunpoint back into the Yankee Empire. And so they did. They just let the U.S. merchant marine be destroyed. And that's why even today you see all these cruise ships, they're registered as Norwegian or Panama or some other country. There are very few of them that are registered as U.S. cruise ships. So that came from the Confederate Navy during the War for Southern Independence that pretty much destroyed the U.S. merchant marines or merchant fleets. Then the other one we wanted to talk about that I've been reading and looking at the pictures in this book were the blockade runners. And we've heard a lot about the blockade runners and their attempt to try to supply the South during the war and slip past the Federal blockade, and how they were able to do that with some pretty ingenious sailing techniques. And we're going to ask you, Eddie, for a trivia question. Who was the most famous Confederate blockade runner in the history of all the blockade runners? And you've probably
Rhett
even
Butler.
Seen him in a movie. That's what I was going to say, give you a hint. You saw him Rhett in a movie. Butler. That scene where they were having that big ball to raise money for the cause, and the old Dr. Meade's up there going, and now we want to introduce a very famous, one of our most successful blockade runners, that will-o'-the-wisp of the bounding main, Captain Rhett Butler. And they're all cheering and hollering. And
yes.
Scarlett said, well, I didn't know you were a hero. And he said, I'm not. I'm in it just for profit. And which is pretty much true, because they said, after your ship that you owned, and they were all private. That wasn't the Confederate government that were doing this. They were privately owned. But after your ship made its second voyage from England to the South or wherever you were picking up supplies to run the blockade and get back in, after you made two trips, your ship was paid for, and everything after that was strictly profit.
Wow.
So as long as there were ports that were open and guarded by forts, these blockade runners could come in at night down the coastline and then make a break for the open port there at Charleston or Wilmington or Mobile or wherever the South still controlled a port, and get the supplies in there and get them sold. In fact, they were selling so many things to the civilians, the Confederate government had to say, okay, a certain percentage of what you bring in is going to have to be military, either military equipment or ammunition or whatever, or uniforms or medical supplies to try to maintain the armies. So that was, and then the Confederate government would pay them for it, of course, but they just put a stipulation that part of it had to be military supplies that were bringing it in. So I think that would be interesting. This book that I'm talking about, that naval history of the warships and naval battles of the Civil War, has got a whole chapter in the back of it and lists a lot of these blockade runners and talks about, you know, how they were especially built to be very fast ships that could outrun the blockade squadron, and how they designed them and the color they painted them so that they would blend in with the coastline at night when they were making runs into these ports. So anyway, that would be a good program for us one of these days. We might have
love
that on tap. So anyway, that was one of our August events, the battle at Mobile Bay on August the 5th in 1864. And that closed down Mobile as a port for the blockade runners, because they no longer had a large Confederate naval ship that could challenge the wooden-hulled ships in the blockade and knock them out. And then they lost Fort Morgan and Fort Gaines, so they weren't able to keep the port open. And what the forts did, they had long enough range artillery that if the Yankee blockade ships got in too close to Charleston or too close to Wilmington or Savannah or whatever, these forts had the range, the artillery in these forts had the range to really do some damage to the federal ships that were in the blockade squadron. So they had to stay back away from the range of the federal Confederate guns. And some of these heavy artillery pieces had a range of up to a mile or a mile and a half. So that meant that the federal blockade squadron had to stay at least a mile and a half away from the port of Savannah or Charleston or Wilmington or wherever to stay out of range of this heavy Confederate artillery in these forts, which meant that the blockade runners coming in at night had an opening of about a mile that if they could slip past the federal blockade squadron, they were, and get within a mile of the fort, of the harbor there, they were pretty safe to come on in to the harbor. And they would have different kind of signals and lighthouses they would set up to show exactly where the coastline was and how they could get in there. And then what they would do, a lot of times, the Confederates would put lights on smaller ships and send them out into the Atlantic or the Gulf at night to fool the federal Navy, and thinking that was the lighthouse, and they were pretty safe to go to the left or right of that, and they would run aground because they'd put it in a place where it was really shallow.
And mean-spirited.
They thought that was the lighthouse that was warning them where the rocky shoals were. So anyway, that was a little bit of history on the Confederate Navy for today. And like we said, Confederates weren't completely unable to build ships. And but the problem was, like we said, they built 22 of those ironclad ships during the course of the war. But as the federal armies closed in on Savannah or Charleston from the land side, they had to destroy their own ships to keep them from falling to the enemy. So hope our listeners learned a little bit about the Confederate Navy and the events of August 5th of 1864. We will check with you next week then, Eddie.
Well, you outdid yourself again. I think this two in a row about as good as I've ever heard. That's the most interesting, and plus it's entertaining. But get that book read if you can, Gene, and I would love to hear you give a report, a more of a report. I already have more questions to ask when you come back.
Okay.
Anyway, thank you so much, Gene.
For you.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Miss Lizzie, and thank you, Blood River Radio family. And God willing, same time, same place. We'll be back here next week. Good night, everybody.